had the dubious pleasure to talk about the U.S. So, I mean, it's a little embarrassing in some ways when a slide goes up that Kyrgyzstan has needle exchange program and opiate substitution in the prisons, a true harm reduction strategy for prisoners in Kyrgyzstan, and what do we have? We have the whole, right? You know, that's pretty much what people get as their strategy. So my contention, I guess, is I'm going to try to prove to you that the U.S. prisons are dangerous to the public's health today. And the U.S. is truly a nation that loves prisons. We'll hear a little bit more about that. I won't go over we have already talked about. These are some of the statistics that have already been mentioned. I just want to point out that the rate for the incarceration rate for African Americans is 4,630 per 100,000, and blacks make up 15% of the illicit drug users in the U.S., but comprise 37% of those arrested for drug use, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. More than $40 billion is spent on incarceration every year. It's important to remember that the prosecution and detention system is only one factor in determining the crime rate, and prisons really have less to do with the volume of crime than does the unemployment rate and the number of men in the population between the ages of 19 and 26. You have to know that only 1-2% of those arrested for property crimes are convicted of anything, and that's 20% for assault and 40% for homicide. So most crimes remain unsolved. And really, most the average crime in the community remains uninvestigated. And that's probably a lot true of corporate crime as well. The likelihood of punishment as a deterrent ranks behind the unemployment rate and the young male population numbers in determining the crime rate. Now, there are very specific forces that led the U.S. in going from an incarceration rate in 1980 that was comparable to the present-day European rate to becoming the world's leading jailer. With the rise of the U.S. civil rights movement and the anti-war and social change movements in the 1960s, hopes of the disaffected and the progressives were raised, and the middle class was somewhat unsettled by all of this, and conservative politicians found a distressed population ready for their views. In 1964, the right-wing Republican presidential candidate who lost, Barry Goldwater, said, as you see there, "History shows us that nothing prepares the way for tyranny more than the failure of public officials to keep the streets safe from bullies and marauders." Where were these people? I don't know. Who cared at that point? No one. This was said when the polls showed that people were much more concerned with civil rights and the war in Vietnam than street crime. But law and order politicians began to shape public opinion, playing on racism and the fear of change implied in the anti-crime rhetoric. Richard Nixon, as a presidential candidate, added his thoughts as he rode the wave of law and order by saying doubling the conviction rate would do more to cure crime in America than quadrupling the funds for Humphrey's, his opponent, war on poverty. Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, said when he was president, "President Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to." Aha! So America began returning to the ideology of 100 years before, which attributed street crime and drug use to bad people, dark skin color, not poverty and institutional racism. Now, one of the main problems then becomes, as certain economic factors come into play, what do you do with this dangerous poor? You have to control and dispose of them, and why was this necessary? Well, before the mid-1970s, a working-class kid with a high school education could seek a decent job in a factory with wages adequate to start a family. After 1980, these jobs began drying up severely, and minimum wage service sector jobs remained. For ghetto youth, by the way, it's always worse. So the promise of the federal government's war on poverty was undercut by the U.S. war on the Vietnamese in the 1960s and 1970s. Also, corporate profits began to decline in the 60s from 10% to 6% by 1980. Manufacturing jobs declined 30% in 15 years with a loss of almost 2.5 million jobs. So jobs are contracted out, positions made part-time. You know the story. It's what we, it's a legacy of what we have today, and it's worse now. Inner-city communities lost their economic base, and their social and political activism was brutally suppressed in the 60s and 70s. You've probably heard of COINTELPRO. I hope you have. If you haven't, look it up. It was one such federal program that resulted in assassinations, disruption of community campaigns, and discrediting of legitimate dissent. More than 100 cities experienced riots in their ghettos in the days after Dr. Martin Luther King was murdered on April 4th of 1968. And those factors and others created a circumstance in which any people with a little money began to move from the inner city to the suburbs. Ghetto schools further deteriorated, libraries closed, local businesses were boarded up. The black community began to become what sociologists have called the hyperghetto. Just as the post-World War II baby boomers became of criminal age and unemployment rates rose. Law and order was pushed to the center of the stage, and as Catherine Beckett described in Making Crime Pay, as a result of the prominence of the election campaign, the crime issue received an unprecedented level of political and media attention in 1968, and the conservative initiative bore fruit. By 1969, 81% of those polled believed that law and order had broken down, although there was no actual evidence that it had. And the majority blamed Negroes who start riots and communists for this state of affairs. Under President Reagan, the war on drugs was initiated. Reagan rejected the notion that street crime had socioeconomic causes and said, as we see here, here in the richest nation in the world, where more crime is committed than any other nation, where did he get that? We are told that the answer to this problem is to reduce our poverty. This isn't the answer. Government's function is to protect society from the criminal, not the other way around. Academics fueled the hysteria over street crime with theories of the criminal type and high-rate offender and so-called super predator. Before President Reagan's war on drugs began in 1982, opinion polls showed that only 3% thought that decreasing the supply of drugs was the most important thing to do to reduce crime. 22% thought that decreasing unemployment might be more effective. Only 2% thought that drug use was our most important problem. Those opinions drastically changed as politicians, academics, and pundits joined the anti-drug crusade. Between 86 and 91, the number of state prisoners incarcerated for drug offenses rose from 9 to 21%. In the federal system, drug offender population rose from 25% in 1980 to 61% in 1993. Ultimately, those locked out of the U.S. good life were living with few job opportunities, lousy schools, dilapidated housing stock, empty storefronts, and disrupted and even murdered leadership. Many were forced to move into the underground economy and criminal life. Gang and drug-related violence increased. The ghetto began to be seen as a menacing evil, and the street criminal became the target of law enforcement. Prison sentences were lengthened, parole denied to the deserving, and few politicians would argue against more prison time or even the overtly racist cocaine laws that dealt severe penalties for crack cocaine preferred by blacks and lesser penalty for powder cocaine used by whites. It's the 100-to-1 rule that a sale of 500 grams of powder or 5 grams of rock both result in the same 5-year sentence. That law remains on the books today, resisting congressional vote on it just recently. By 2001, one-third of all young black men were under direct supervision of the criminal prosecution and detention system. 41% of black high school dropouts were behind bars. Poor black men were treated as social junk, to be marginalized with no social power or aspiration, drifting at the edge of society and dying early. Racism taints every level of the prosecution and detention system, from surveillance to arrest, prosecution, and sentencing. With more than 2 million people behind bars, is the U.S. safer in this era of mass incarceration and warehouse prisons? The crime rates tell the story, and we are worse off with higher crime rates in all index crimes than when the right-wing anti-crime effort began in the late 60s. In fact, I would contend that mass incarceration program creates more harm than the crimes from which it's supposed to protect us. In 2002, the Bureau of Justice Statistics released a study showing that more than half of the prisoners were returned to prison within 3 years of being released. In California, it's something near 70%. Most prisoners come to prison from poverty and upon release return to increasingly impoverished communities. I just want to roll a few slides for you just to show you how the prisoners are living these days. These are from prisons in California. And this is triple bunking in so-called dorm settings in gyms or other large rooms. Wherever they can put them, they have them, as California is about 200% overcrowded. This is a dorm facility, people hanging out, nothing to do, sitting around, idle, forced idleness, I call it, and enforced idleness. There's a woman's prison, same deal. Double, triple bunks for years like this. This is, long sentences. This is how people live for years. It reminds me in some ways of how this facility might have looked when it was brand spanking new. Oh yeah, it's different. It's different, but those bunks look somewhat the same, don't they? Most prisoners come to prison from poverty and upon release return to increasingly impoverished communities. In 2002, 43% of the nation's poor were living in severe poverty, the highest rate since 1975, when the social safety net was unraveled by lawmakers as part of what I like to call the Blame the Poor campaign. So, how does this impact prisoners? Well, in the matter of health, prisoners bring to prison a concentration of health problems secondary to poverty, drug use, and trauma. They have high rates of HIV, Hep C and B, TB, diabetes, hypertension, it's a long list, asthma, epilepsy, poor oral health, and musculoskeletal disorders. Despite decades of successful legal action by prisoners and human rights advocates, governments haven't allocated adequate money or organized coherent services for care of prisoners' real needs. If I have time at the end, I'll go back and tell you about a recent example of a public health crisis in the Central Valley of California and how it's managed by our prison system. Prisoners are known to have that high rate of HIV. It's 5 times the general population. Seroconversion among prisoners has been found everywhere it's been studied. Hepatitis C is 100 times more infective than HIV. Prisoners are a profound reservoir of the hepatitis C infected U.S. population, with about 1/3 of those infected are behind bars at any one moment in the United States. Yet little education and treatment is carried out in prison. Moreover, harm reduction strategies are virtually unknown, as I described before. In the matter of mental health, more than 20% of the prisoners have serious psychiatric diagnoses, including schizophrenia, bipolar, other major psychiatric diagnoses, and prisons could play an important part in improving mental health of the population by offering treatment and a respite from chaotic lives and a place to reflect and reorder. But as John Irwin found in his study of prisoners in California, and I will show his book title and such at the end, long sentences in warehouse prisons instead cause difficulty in acting independently on one's own behalf, diminished sense of self, changes in sexual orientation. Prison is a place of exaggerated machismo with frequent sexual predation. And there are other issues, of course, with that. And anger at injustice. Prisoners know they are uneducated and lack employable skills, and they don't have those opportunities when they're in prison. Misery is an important part of incarceration. And from arrest and trial to incarceration, prisoners are treated with hostility and contempt, causing depression and a sense of unworthiness. As the months and years go by, many reject conventional society and embrace the outsider criminal point of view. They have been discarded, so they go elsewhere. They adopt the mores of prison, where they learn racial prejudice. Prisoners are probably the most hyper-racialized environment in the United States. And they adopt the vocabulary, mannerisms, and grooming standards of the prison culture. They also know that they're being economically exploited, and many prisoners feel that they're just, raw materials, $40,000 each, for a $40 billion industry. And we can talk about the phone companies and other things if we have time at during the discussion. In conclusion, I just want to say that the U.S. war on crime and illegal drug use hasn't decreased either. But that wasn't the purpose. The political goal has been to divert the public from pressing social and economic problems and from corporate crime to street crime. By the way, Enron caused people a money loss in one company. Then the entire accumulated loss from all ordinary property crimes and larceny in the United States in the year that Enron came down. The social goal has been to neutralize a new dangerous non-white ghetto youth, forcing them to lay low at the edge of society. And our communities have been harmed by this strategy in these ways that I outline. And I'll just mention them, and we can think about them more on our own. The diversion of tax money into building and maintaining prisons, the disruption of family and social fabric of poor communities, the prison culture having a deeper impact in our communities by the disenfranchisement of felons, and by social vindictiveness. And I say here personal safety, and I would say security delusions, really, by the average citizen. We place a desire for cooperative organizations. And finally, the health of the public is ignored, and prisoners released to communities increasingly not equipped to assist them. I think The Warehouse Prison by Dr. John Irwin, Roxbury Publishing, is an incredibly insightful study. He goes to one prison, which is an average medium security prison in the California system, and does intense sociological and ethnographic research and comes up with these kinds of ideas for which I used as a basic resource for this paper. Thank you very much.